Good morning, Charlottesville. You are listening to Straight Talk on WPBC-FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Straight Talk is a series of interviews and conversations about legal and social justice issues affecting our community. I am your host, Andre Hakes. On today's show, we will be speaking with Afton Bradley, the Trans Health Services Program Manager at the Fan Free Clinic in Richmond, and with Dr. Nancy McLaren, the Medical Director of the Teen and Young Adult Health Center at UVA, about trans healthcare issues. Welcome, Afton.
Thank you.
Welcome, Dr. McLaren.
Thank you.
So tell me a little bit, just sort of to begin with, Afton, let's start with you, about your background and kind of how you ended up in this job.
Yeah, so I originally started out pursuing an education in the medical field, and through learning some advocacy, through my experiences of being a transgender man, coming out as a transgender man growing up around this area, in fact, I struggled a lot with advocating and accessing proper care, both mental health and medical, and that led me to pursue a career in social work. And through that career, I really wanted to get back involved in the care that I was unable to attain and make it more accessible for other folks like me. And so I ended up, thankfully and luckily, finding a job at Fan Free Clinic after obtaining my MSW at VCU, and was able to get into this field and continue to train medical providers and mental health providers and help get trans folks, especially in Richmond, who don't have health insurance and a lack of income, the health care that they need. And so it was my own story and my own experiences combined with an education that kind of led to the perfect opportunity at Fan Free.
So you just sort of found yourself in a situation where you could have used some better systems, and then you went on and got the skills and the education you needed to make those better systems for the next generation of people.
Yeah, exactly. You know, sometimes what we notice is that it's the community that knows more oftentimes than the people that they're going to get the care and services that they need. So I said, you know, I have the privileges and tools, and I'm intelligent enough to go on and continue care. And I think that one of the benefits that a lot of our clients appreciate is the fact that at Fan Free, not only do they have competent and compassionate providers, but they also get to speak to another trans person. And I think having that relationship and that tie to the community has been very impactful.
Well, that makes sense. When were you at VCU?
So I went to VCU for a semester when I was 18, but as far as my graduate school education, I graduated in 2013.
Gotcha. My wife went to VCU. she was at VCU getting her MSW when I was in law school. So, but that was, years ago. And I remember, you know, hearing from her about that experience and about what that was like. And she was out at the time. I mean, she's not trans, but she's gay. And it was a little bit of an issue up there. I don't know. What was your experience more recently?
Yeah. So when I was 18, that would have been in 2007 when I went as a freshman. And that was actually a very uncomfortable situation. I wanted to live on campus, but they told me, because I was trans at that time, that they didn't know what to do with me, and actually gave me the amount of money that it would take to live on campus for me to go find an apartment, because I had a scholarship to go there for free, the presidential scholarship. When I came back as a graduate student, graduate school is a little bit different, so you're not on campus as much. So I did notice that there is much more visibility, that in terms of leadership and academia and professors, that there were, you know, there's an out trans woman who's a professor at VCU, which is awesome.
Oh, that's great.
And she works on the medical campus, which is even better. But so that was a great opportunity and experience. But I talked, and I still work with, because of the advocacy I do, you know, in my spare time, with a lot of undergraduate students. And I know that they still struggle a lot. And I was coming from a school in West Virginia where I completed my undergrad. So that, I think, also kind of shaped a big shift, because we definitely struggled a lot in that school, West Virginia, to making things better. And so I think it was a combination of, I had the better tools and kind of knew what I was looking for, but also just there was definitely a substantial growth just in a short 6-year time span, for sure.
Well, it sounds like it. It sounds like things are getting better. So Dr. McLaren, tell me a little bit about your background. You've got the Teen and Young Adult Health Center. You don't deal only with trans issues, but it sounds like you deal with them a fair amount.
We do. I did my medical training at Emory in Atlanta, and then was very involved in community health centers in Atlanta. And we moved up here about 17 years ago, and I really wanted to work on community issues and community health, mainly for youth and young adults. And the one thing that was going on at UVA that sort of appealed to me was the Teen Health Center at that time. Mm-hmm. And they needed a pediatrician to be on staff. And so I started there just very part-time. We have three kids, and they were young. And we weren't sure we were going to stay here in Charlottesville. And then I really loved the work, and we were able to be able to stay here. And we've been here.
Charlottesville sucks you in.
It really sucks you in. And our kids didn't want to leave afterwards, and we just really liked it here. And I really liked that I was having an opportunity to get involved with some community issues. We at the center had always wanted to and had tried to be a provider for my sexual minority youth. Mm-hmm. And but at that point in time, I had not really seen any trans patients. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until a patient came to me about 4 years ago with his mom and really was in need of services. And just as Afton was describing, there weren't any services that they were finding here in Charlottesville. And that, to me, just spoke so strongly that here was this need for this patient and we needed to be doing something else, that was our role in the community and my responsibility and our clinic's responsibility to find out what the needs are.
4 years ago?
4 years ago.
Okay. Charlottesville has had the AIDS Services Group for a long time, mm-hmm. which then morphed into Thrive, and I think they were sort of trying to fill some of that.
And they did, but they started at age 16.
Oh, I see.
And we started at age 11.
Right.
What thing we were able to do with the Affordable Care Act is we've expanded our services up to age 26 because there still is a big gap there. And in fact, when Thrive had to quit providing services, we were able to pick up the slack there for them.
Okay.
In reference to providing services.
That's a good thing.
So that for us was, we aren't able to provide everybody because we only go up to age 26, but we've been able to try and figure out within the university, we've been working on trying to find other services. So with this young man and his mother, at that time, they'd been denied services at UVA and at VCU as far as endocrine services. And
Why were they denied services?
The people that they met with didn't feel comfortable providing them services, especially at that age. Mm-hmm.
They feel like this kid is too young to know what they want, and therefore, you know, we're not
too young, and this was something that wasn't going to stick, and it was going to change. They just felt very strongly that they weren't able to make their own decisions about what was going on with them. And my sense with him was that he was pretty clear on what was going on and that what was happening by
not
providing services
every weekend. It's Charlottesville's only EDM on air
94.7. And both for him and for his family, I was able to connect them with someone up at DC Children's who was involved with providing transgender care, who then connected me with an endocrinologist up in Baltimore. So my first four patients all had to leave this area and go to Baltimore and D.C., and that just didn't seem right. And so I was able to go back to someone else, a person who had trained here at UVA and had gone down to L.A. for her training and then came back, Dr. Bert Solizano, and I said, Shirley, can you consider providing services for these patients? Mm-hmm. It seems mm-hmm. crazy that we have to send them so far away.
Right.
And so she and I then became very involved, and she said, yes, let's learn about this, let's learn more, because we had a huge learning curve. It was not something we had ever been taught in medical school. It was not something I'd been taught in residency. So we had this huge learning curve of what were the needs, what kind of services did they need, what resources did exist in Charlottesville, how could we help develop those services more, and have since been able to go on and develop a transgender health clinic and it's a multidisciplinary clinic where they come actually to our center, because one of the things we like about the Teen Young Adult Health Center is it is a place that we think people feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. And it is a place where we're small, so we can really manage how people interact and how people can be respectful, how they know what pronouns to use. And we have, our front desk person is wonderful, and then our nurses are terrific. And it was a small group that we could all train together and learn what to do. We've been very lucky. Right about the same time, the head of the Division of Endocrinology, Pediatric Endocrinology, came from Ohio State, where he was involved with the transgender health clinic there. So he's really added
He
came to UVA.
Oh, boy, that is lucky.
It's very lucky. And so he's really been a great advocate in helping us sort of expand our clinic, helping us figure out how we can draw on resources within the university, because we were also concerned about what happens to these patients as they age out of our care. Where do they go?
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been able to get the adult endocrinology folks involved. They had been seeing a few transgender patients, but we really wanted to provide services there. We've been talking with a surgeon that is getting involved, and we've been trying to find other resources both there as well as in the community, especially mental health resources.
Dr. McLaren, you're not trans.
No.
What made you care about this issue enough to take all this effort and do these things for this community?
I went to medical school because I wanted to serve underserved people, and I actually thought I was always going to work overseas. And then what I found out by especially coming back here, but even in Atlanta where I worked, that there were a lot of people that needed services, that people weren't interested in providing services with them. And I think just in the center where we were, that was sort of our mission, was to provide services to those who can't get services.
So you were just kind of looking around at who is not getting helped, discovered this community of people who's not getting helped and decided to try to fix
it. I think they guided me. I mean, they came to me and I was open and ready to listen and to say, whoa, I can't believe that someone would provide services. I mean, that to me just blew me away.
Right.
And so I just thought, we have to help these people. You know, they have strong needs, and it was so clear how it was affecting their lives and their ability to function. And it was also something I really wanted to learn more about.
Well, the community is very lucky to have found an advocate such as you.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it, and I've gotten to meet such great people. I think we as a group have been able to form this Trans Health Alliance, which has brought people in just not in Charlottesville, but from the surrounding region, from Richmond. And just the change in 4 years here has been just tremendous as far as there's still a lot to do.
Well, let's talk about the Trans Health Alliance. Okay. What is the Trans Health Alliance? Afton, you want to field that one?
So one thing that we know when it comes to providers, as you know, we've kind of already discussed, is that it is this lack of education and this lack of friend, because it is something, like it's already been said, it's not taught in medical schools. You don't get it in your residency experience oftentimes. And so the one thing that we know that can help is getting other providers together and to help doing that outreach and to help increase those spaces. Because as we said, like UVA has some great services now, but we know that it can't just be one place that somebody can go to. We have to fill in those gaps. And so what we did through a great organization with UVA providers, some community providers, and then the leaders of the PFLAG group here locally, the PFLAG Blue Ridge group, came together and formed this Trans Health Alliance. And it's a group that is a coalition of mainly providers, both medical and mental health, also some community advocates as well. And then, as I've stated, the PFLAG leaders. And, you know, we get together, and our mission is to, on our website, we have a provider list, so that way community folks can go there and see where they can go and access care. And it's very detailed so that they can figure out exactly what they want and easy to understand.
So if I was a trans person listening to this broadcast this morning,
yes,
and I was looking for some healthcare services, I could what? Google Trans Healthcare Alliance?
Yep. You can Google that. You can go to the website. It's really easy. It's just our acronym. So it's www.thacva.org. And you click on the provider tab. It's a map. And you can check off if you're looking for hormones, check off the hormone box. It pulls up hormone providers. If you're looking for mental health, check off that box.
So T-H-A-C-V-A?
Mm-hmm.
What's T-H-A-C?
Yeah, THA is for Trans Health Alliance. Uh-huh. CVA is for Central Virginia.
Central Virginia. Mm-hmm. Okay, Trans Health Alliance, Central Virginia.
Yes.
Got it.
Yeah, and if you Google it, it's going to be the first thing that pops up, too.
Okay.
And so you go there, and one of the other great things is that maybe what you're looking for isn't there. And so there's also a Contact Us page. And so if you're a community person looking for something, shoot us an email if you're not finding it, and one of us can help try to find it for you.
Who answers those emails?
So primarily, so Karen Barker, who was the who leads the PFLAG group here, she was kind of the catalyst for getting this group together. She has been a tremendous advocate, I think, for issues all across the state. And so the emails do go to her directly. And what she does is, if it's something she can screen, she answers it. If it's something that she needs to bring out, we have a closed listserv. And so it goes out to the providers. We have a membership form, so you have to agree to certain things.
Mm-hmm. Like confidentiality?
Yep, confidentiality. Also, you know, there's a commitment that you are going to be providing, you know, these services, this care, to not discriminate, to provide compassionate care. Because we do also, the one thing that's great about that website is that a provider maybe go to it. And if they are like, well, I'm not on this list, but I do this care, there's a provider sign up so they can sign up right there on the website. And then again, that goes to Karen. We screen it, decide if mm-hmm. that person's appropriate. And even within that, we link them, you know, it's like, while you're reading this agreement, here's some education pieces that maybe you don't know about to go learn more. So I think it's a great tool and a resource for that. And so that's kind of one thing, is making those resources available. And then the other piece was doing outreach and events like this Trans Healthcare Symposium, which we'll be doing next week, to try to help educate. Because I said, I think the biggest gap isn't that providers don't care and don't want to do the work. It's just that nobody has really told them. And so I think there's this kind of taboo and stigma that trans healthcare is this really difficult task to take on. And it's a specialty type of medicine, when depending on what type of care you're providing, whether it's hormone treatment, you know, mental health counseling, there, it's all things that are within the capacity of what your skill sets you for. It's just nobody mm-hmm. has sat down and just showed the actual medical pieces or the counseling pieces of it. So that's our main goal, is to kind of work towards destigmatizing that and getting more providers to learn and provide those educational opportunities, because there aren't any here.
Okay, so this is one of those moments when I'm supposed to say, you're listening to Straight Talk on WPVC 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. And so let me turn now to you, Doc. I've got a little piece of paper in front of me here that you handed me this morning that says that there is going to be a Trans Healthcare Symposium, which is a training for mental health and medical providers, on April 27th, which is coming right up.
Right,
Wednesday. Looks like an all-day event, 8:30 to 5 p.m., and it's safe space training, workshops, local resources. This is something that medical providers can, or mental health care providers can, sign up to if they're interested in learning more about this.
That's right, and it also can be other people that are interested in learning more. The focus is really going to be on improving skills of and comfort levels with healthcare providers, as well as the mental health providers. But other people who are very interested in learning more certainly can sign up.
In other words, it's not just doctors.
No. And in fact, I think they're, you know, healthcare providers can be a broad spectrum. It can mm-hmm. be social workers. It can be physical therapists. It can be mental health providers, for sure, nurse practitioners, mm-hmm. PAs, sort of really a broad spectrum. We have some medical students that are going to be coming, which I'm really excited about. We've shared it with residents, so we're hoping there'll be some residents that come, having an opportunity for them to learn things that I never learned.
Would it be an appropriate event for people who are on the receiving services end, or more just for providers?
Had that discussion. I think people could come. I'm not sure that they will get as much out of it. Uh-huh. As, you know, our goal is really to train the people to give them services. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so that's where the focus is going to be. We would never not let someone come. They're certainly welcome to come. But the focus is really trying to train the providers.
So there are probably more appropriate programs for those people. But if this was what was in the neighborhood and you wanted to come, you could.
Absolutely.
It looks like it is a $25 cost, and scholarships are available. Tell me how, if it looks like there's a website on here, and it's the same one you just read me, the thacba.org website, where you can register as a provider for this symposium.
Right, and certainly you can go on that same site, and it will link you to the event sign-up area and all. And then you have to get in touch through that to let us know whether you need scholarship funding or not.
And I see a bunch of sponsorships down here at the bottom. I see all these logos, and one of them I recognize is the Charlottesville Pride Community Network, which is having a really cool float in the Dogwood Parade today, let me say, just pulled by a really fabulous jacked-up red pickup truck. Glossy, shiny. God, it's really inspiring. I also see Roseme on here. I see the LGBTQ Center at UVA, Virginia Department of Health, University of Virginia Children's Hospital, the Women's Initiative, Equality Virginia, PFLAG of the Blue Ridge, the Mudhouse Coffee Roasters, and Oakhart Social. I don't know what Oakhart Social is.
It's a business in town.
Okay.
I don't know as much about it, but I know that they've been very supportive of LGBTQ events and activities. And one of the things they're helping us with is the food and support services.
Well,
we actually have gotten great support for this event.
And so if you really are, if you're out there in the community today and you see the opportunity to go visit Oakheart Social or the Mud House, for example, right. And thank them for their sponsorship of this Trans Healthcare Symposium, please do that. Yeah. It's wonderful to see local community businesses get into something like that.
Yeah, we're very excited about it.
So tell me a little bit about what this symposium is going to cover.
So the first part of the symposium is going to focus more on the medical needs, and we're going to start out with actually Dr. Libby, who's one of our chief residents in pediatrics and has been very involved with ROSME, is going to be talking about how you make the place where patients would come patient-friendly and comfortable, and what kinds of things are important to know about that. He's also going to spend some time going through terms and definitions and talking about that so people would understand sort of what when someone says something, what they're talking about or what they mean. Then I'm going to talk about the role of primary care provider for youth and what kind of needs there are, because one of the things I think is important, as Afton was saying, is we need to look at them as a whole person and what their needs are. And that, yes, there may be specific needs that they have in reference to cross-sex hormone needs that we can help them with. But we have to remember that they have all other kinds of needs.
They also need the flu shot?
They need the flu shot. They need help with sore throats. They need help with any reproductive health care. We spend a lot of issues with that. And just any questions that may come up for them. I will talk about that. There's going to be a family practitioner from UVA, Dr. Casey, who's going to talk about taking care of older transgender patients, because that's an area that I don't know as much about, and we certainly want to make sure that we can transition them from providing care at this age to older providers.
It sounds like a lot of this area of care has sort of sprung out of organizations that deal with youth. And so then you hit a point where you age out, and what do you do?
Yeah, and that's the issue. And so we definitely want to focus on that. Dr. Bert Solizano is going to talk more specifically about the endocrine treatments. Mm-hmm. And then Eleanor Hutchins, who's a fellow in endocrine, who's actually going to stay in the area, which we're really excited about, is going to talk about the needs and treatments for older transgender persons, and also treating how you manage that with chronic diseases that start to come up in older age.
Now, are we talking about older as in older than 26? Or are we talking about older as in, you know, sort of later in life retirement age care?
I think she's going to try and cover that whole spectrum. Yeah, but a lot of her focus is going to be more on later in life also, because that is an area we felt, I know Dr. Bert Solizano and I haven't talked about that. We don't take care of that age, and we feel that's really important, because there are other issues that come up, and even issues of what happens when someone gets older and needs nursing home care.
Right, what do you do?
Or rehab care.
That's a gay community issue for sure, and something I've been hearing some about. There's an attorney in town, Doris Geldman, who does elder care law, who's gay and who has some interest in that kind of stuff, and interested in the nursing home area too. I might recommend this to Doris.
Yeah, I think it's really an area that hasn't been talked about as much, and as all of us age, that is an issue. You want to make sure that there's services and care.
So you're gonna cover, the initial steps. You're gonna cover the dealing with the pediatric patients. You're gonna cover on up through later in life care. What else are you gonna talk about? What's the next presenter? Or what else is gonna happen?
There's going to be a special luncheon presenter, invited guest, that's going to come and talk about some issues in reference to transgender care. And then after that, the afternoon's going to break up for mental health providers. They're going to meet with other mental health providers to talk specifically about providing care to transgender patients. But also, one of the things you need, at least within our system, and it varies different places, you often need a mental health provider to make the diagnosis of gender dysphoria, and then also to say, yes, you are ready for, this patient is ready for cross-sex hormone treatment or ready for surgery. And there are a lot of providers in the community that are very interested and have experience working with transgender patients, but they didn't feel strong that they had enough experience. And so several of the providers that do have a lot of experience, we're going to have a workshop for them.
Tell me a little bit about that, about having to have a doctor or a physician say, you know, you have this diagnosis, this gender dysphoria diagnosis. I understand it doesn't work that way everywhere.
It doesn't work that way. Our providers go by the guidelines of the Endocrine Society, and so feel very strongly that that they do need to have the diagnosis, especially, mm-hmm. I think, for us working with youth mm-hmm. and younger patients. We want to make sure that the diagnosis is there, and also their parents want to make sure.
Right.
And so I think this is a way of getting that, of needing that. And even our adult providers at UVA are requiring that. And I don't think you could talk about it at the Fanfrey Clinic. I don't know if you require that. Certainly our surgeons are requiring it also,
right.
Even the surgeons out of the area.
Well, it seems like, I mean, as an attorney, it sounds like it would be a liability issue. I can see, you know, some parent or someone, maybe even in the government, with all the sort of some right-winger coming in and saying, you know, you've committed medical malpractice by doing this without, you know, this level of authorization. Right. Is that kind of maybe part of the picture there? And
I don't know, because you at clinic, do you guys require a letter?
Afton, tell me about Fanfrey Clinic, because I think you guys have a different standard.
We do. Ours is a little bit unique in terms of Virginia. The gender dysphoria and diagnosis piece has been a controversial issue for a long time. As some people may know, it was not too long ago. It was in the 1970s when we removed, you know, somebody being gay as a, you know, mental health rate issue. There's a lot of advocates that argue that, you know, should gender dysphoria, should a trans person's identity be in the DSM at all, because of that mental health component and that stigma that kind of stays with that. And it's a hard argument. There's arguments for both sides. And we know one of the biggest pieces, especially in the United States, is that often a lot of our treatment is dependent on insurance companies, and insurance companies need a diagnosis, right?
Company want that diagnosis before they're paid for anything.
So that's
right?
A tough piece. The other piece, too, is that, you know, we also, there are the WPATH standards of care. The WPATH is the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, and they kind of give two options when it comes to providing hormone treatment. Now, with youth, the criteria is different, and a letter from a mental health provider is definitely recommended. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think any expert or advocate or provider would, you know, argue that that's a very important thing to do, because at that age, you know, we know that when it comes to, you know, gender identity and gender expression, there's lots of things that need to be worked out. And again, especially parents have to be involved in this consent process. So mm-hmm. that holistic piece is really important. We operate under informed consent at Fanfrey. And so what that means is WPATH does outlay this as an option for adults. And it means that instead of needing a letter diagnosis, what somebody would have to do is they do need to be evaluated to make sure that they have the ability to make informed consent. And this is a key piece, is this is a medical piece. And so, you know, I always throw out the fact that in the DSM, it's the only diagnosis where somebody's treatment says your mind is right and we're going to make your body congruent with your mind, right? That's an interesting paradox. So
that is interesting.
What we like to do is, what I do the intake appointment. So I perform a full biopsychosocial assessment to make sure this person has the ability to make decisions, that they don't have any other crisis mental health issues that need immediate treatment. So if somebody came in actively suicidal, we would not obviously want to put them on hormone treatment at that time, correct?
Right.
Once we've gone through that piece and I've assessed that they are, in fact, you know, ready to make this decision, and also talk a little bit about their experience, just making sure hormones make sense, like their goals line up with what's going to happen. They're truly understanding the permanency of this piece. We talk through all of the risk and benefits, and I move them along to the medical provider, who also does a similar assessment too. And so they still have to go through this assessment piece and still be seen by two different people. But we know, especially because we serve folks who do not have health insurance and often are unemployed. And so we don't want to add that extra barrier of saying, now you need to find a mental health provider, as we've been talking throughout the course of this discussion, knowing that there aren't many places to go. And so that can delay care, can add an extra burden and a step. And the one thing we want to do is not create more barriers, take them away. And that's what we saw informed consent as doing. And there are other clinics in the country that do that, but oftentimes it is clinics. It's not private providers, because mm-hmm. we have the benefit and fortunate space of being in a clinic that has this multidisciplinary team. So I think that also kind of lends to this model.
Mm-hmm.
more so than if you're a private, you know, endocrinologist, you don't have access to a mental health care provider right there with you. And I think that, you know, you want to make sure that, and also too, we, because we don't take insurance, we're not limited to seeing a patient for a certain amount of time. So we see patients for a little bit longer appointments, oftentimes with doctor's offices for anything, you know, we're limited,
right.
15 minutes. 15 minutes would not be appropriate to do an assessment. We get a full hour with our patients. And so that, I think, is what we have the space to accommodate that model. But often I think a lot of spaces really don't have that ability. And so then a letter referral is the best piece. And that's why we wanted to do in the symposium, this letter writing workshop, because there are some particular spaces around it. And I work with a lot of counselors being a social worker, and a lot of them are scared by it. Mm-hmm. And then when we really do this training to talk through it, they're like, oh, well, we've already kind of talked through that in session. I didn't know. I thought I had to have some special license and special credential to write this letter. I wouldn't realize I can do this. And we've already went through that process.
Right.
So it's just, again, just kind of making the information known and out there.
And so part of this Trans Healthcare Symposium that you guys are going to be doing on April 27th is going to be a letter writing clinic where you're basically going to be educating healthcare professionals about how these sorts of letters are written to help people get services.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's you know, what we were speaking about when Nancy was speaking about in terms of that split off in the afternoon. So the medical providers are going to go into their own space to talk about medical issues. And then that's where mental health care providers are going to come in and learn more about, you know, more of the logistics in terms of, okay, you're providing safe, you know, appropriate care with your clients. Now let's talk about the next steps and how we can link them into the medical piece of this transition.
Got it. Well, thank you very much. We're going to take a break for just a moment, and we'll be back.
This week on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call with Rick Moore, Khaki Dimmick, Executive Director of the Thomas Jefferson Area Coalition for the Homeless, will be the guest. They'll be talking about the way American cities have sought to eradicate homelessness and taking your calls. Tune in live this Sunday at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. Brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the Markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel.
You're listening to Straight Talk on 94.7 WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. Brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. If you'd like to participate in the program, it's 434-284-9470. And now, back to your host, Andre Hakes.
So I don't think any discussion of trans healthcare issues certainly involving any kind of mental health would be complete without a discussion of North Carolina's recent bathroom laws. Do you guys want to speak to what's going on down there and what kind of impact that might be having on the trans community?
I'm going to let you take that.
It's all you, Afton. Tell us how you feel about that.
Well, personally, I'm not too happy about it, and I think that I can speak for probably the whole trans community saying that it's you know, definitely feeling like we're making a lot of, you know, steps backwards and not forwards. I think what we've seen happen in the last few years is a lot of progress, and I would say this definitely is you know, whenever you have progress, you always meet resistance, right? So, you know, this bill, for folks who do not know about it, it would make it so that, you know, any trans person, when trying to use any type of public accommodation, restroom, shower, locker room, would have to go with what is on, you know, like what their genitalia, what's like on their birth certificate kind of thing would do. Now how they are going to check that actually in practice is one question that's always been in mind, because what we saw this year was it wasn't just North Carolina. There were many states that proposed very similar bills. Virginia actually proposed a bathroom bill, but luckily, our governor and, you know, our assembly shot that bill down. And we have a very supportive governor in terms of LGBTQ issues right now who would have vetoed it even if it came across, is what he kept saying. So
luckily
we kind of missed that. But North Carolina is not too far from us. And it's very disappointing, because what we know is that when it comes to bathroom spaces, this argument back and forth about can trans people use what bathroom often comes with this misperceived notion of safety in terms of oftentimes it's people perceiving that trans women coming into a women's restroom are going to hurt or assault other women. And what we know is that that's not the case. We know that often it's trans women who are most vulnerable and the ones who are the most victims of violence. And then often too, people forget that trans men exist. And so that visibility also is not there. So people don't think of the flip side of trans men would now have to use women's restrooms. So then you have somebody who as a male masculine presenting space coming into a women's restroom, which can also be problematic.
All right, so
and
I just
unsafe.
Have to give the visual here that you're like sitting here in the studio with me with a full beard mm-hmm. in your camo baseball cap. I think I see chest hair, some tats, right? You know, and I'm thinking you walking into the ladies' room. Not really, probably a good idea for anybody.
No, I mean, it's not. It's definitely an imposed risk, right? Because then I'm pushing my mask.
If you walk into the ladies' room, the ladies are going to scream and hit you with their purses.
I mean, I would anticipate that because I'm pushing my masculinity on them, which is not safe
you're
either.
Like,
and
like,
what that's also
here?
One piece that's been interesting with this bill is that we've seen a lot of trans men kind of put forth that argument. And I don't like highlighting that argument because, again, when we think about this vulnerability and safety, it takes away from the people who are most at risk, which we know are trans women and specifically trans women of color. So I like highlighting that.
Well, I think you're at
notion.
Risk in that scenario. I mean, you walk into a women's bathroom, you know, let's say somebody screams and the cops mm-hmm. come in.
Yeah.
You're a dude. What are you doing in the ladies' room? You look like a perv.
Yeah. And then I have to unzip my pants and be like, look at this is what I got.
But I think you're
it is difficult. It is vulnerable. I think every trans person with this bill is vulnerable. I think it questions safety for everybody, for sure. I definitely think that any trans person with this bill would feel unsafe, and often they would feel like they have nowhere to go. And I think it is something that's important to bring up in health. One training tool that we like to use, there's an organization in New York called the Sylvia Rivera Law Project. Sylvia Rivera, for folks who may not know, encourage you to go look up who she is. She was one of the leading beginners in the trans rights activist movement and is a remarkable human being to learn more about. But their organization has a video called Toilet Training, and it talks about this bathroom need and explains like that trans people, especially students, I know even when I was in high school, I would avoid public restrooms. You're holding in what you need to let go for hours and hours on a day, and that can lead to really substantial, serious medical complications, not alone the mental health pieces of where can I go? Where can I feel safe? And this bill shows that you're like, there are a lot of people around me in my own neighborhood who agree with this bill. They, of course, can't support me. So again, that mental health component, what we saw, an article actually came out 2 days ago showing that they saw a spike, like an exponential spike in calls to a suicide hotline from trans people after this bill because of the fear and stigma that got pushed forward.
Well, you're so basically telling this group of people, everybody hates you, go to work.
Exactly.
That's going to have an effect on the mental health of the people
So and that's what we try to think is like you have to take this I think kind of the whole notion of when we talk about trans anything and issues is that whole person, right? Because we always focus in on one piece, whether it's what their genitalia look like, or with healthcare we only think about hormones, and it's like this whole person is involved. And once again, this is another piece that says you are not worthy, you're not welcome here, and validating who you are, which is kind of
bullying.
The worst thing that can happen.
It's a sort of social bullying that the legislatures are sometimes engaging in. Mm-hmm. But we have some good news in Virginia on this, don't we? I mean, we had a recent Fourth Circuit win of a sort. You want to talk about that?
One thing that was very exciting, for a while now, there's been a case that has been argued. There's a local trans teenager. He identifies as a man, so a local trans man. And he was in Gloucester, and he was just trying to use the guy's bathroom at his high school because that's how he identifies. He presents very masculinely. And they told him no. And so it went to their local court, and that judge said that, no, you're not allowed to do that. That judge actually said, paraphrasing a tiny bit, but saying, I'm afraid of where this country is going.
Oh.
And would not hear and turned away hearing the ACLU's argument.
Mm-hmm.
So then that went forth to the Fourth District, as you said, and they upheld the U.S. Department of Education's stance, which said that if you are trying to use public restroom, like in a public school, any type of education space, that you are allowed to use the restroom that matches your gender identity and expression. It didn't say that you had to have surgery or had to have certain hormone treatment, because again, we talked about that if you're under 18, got to have parental consent, lots of barriers and blocks there. And so this says you have to use what's accommodating. And the interesting piece, which will play out, what we're going to see play out, I think, in the next couple of weeks, is tying into that North Carolina bill, because it does, what they were using with the U.S. Department of Education was saying this is in strict violation of Title IX. And so now North Carolina's bill, at least when it comes to education spaces, is now in violation of Title IX. And so now federally they are violating the law, at least in that space. So can't apply to everything, but it will be interesting to see how they're going to, you know, keep this bill up as, again, more and more. I mean, we've seen businesses pull their, you know, companies away. PayPal is like, you know, we were about to do all this business in North Carolina. We're not doing it now. And so definitely excited to see in Virginia that we had something that got overturned. And now I think that a lot of students, I facilitate and volunteer at Roseme, the one in Richmond. The youth there and the ED there was very excited to hear this overturn. They actually threw like a party that night for group night and brought cake and things in. Because again, it's that law and bullying piece. And that shows the students, they're like, you know, I have this on my side. They're telling me that I can. And so it's that piece of feeling like, you know, you're safe and that you are supported.
The authority is backing me up as a worthy fellow human being. Yeah. Having gotten married recently, I understand.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
How that feels. Yeah. Well, that's kind of a big case. The reason legally that it doesn't invalidate House Bill 22, North Carolina's in the Fourth Circuit, right? So, you know, some people are thinking, well, it should have. That should just knock House Bill 22 to the butt in North Carolina. But the reason it doesn't is because the grounds of the Virginia case are Title IX. They're educational grounds. Mm-hmm. It sort of takes a slice out of the North Carolina law to the extent that it can't be applied to educational institutions now. Although, just like with the gay marriage issue, we'll probably see a lot of refusal to follow the law and you know, lawsuits back and forth. And I mean, fortunately, there's no clerks issuing P licenses, but if there were, we'd probably have some declining.
And what we know too is that, you know, law and daily life are two very different things. And so we know that even in states where there aren't laws, you know, openly discriminating against trans people, that trans people still, you know, face open discrimination when it comes to using spaces. I mean, even I think people whose just gender expression doesn't match. I know plenty of women who just present in a more masculine fashion who, you know, get harassed when trying to use a female restroom. So, you know, we definitely have a long way to go in terms of social acceptance too. So laws are good because then we can say, guess what? We have that authority on our side too. And I think that helps when you're trying to get that clout to move forward.
Why do we even have gender segregated bathrooms? I mean, what put us here? I mean, I get that, like, you know, there's a nudity issue, right? And in men's rooms, sometimes there are urinals, right? You know, and so this idea that you don't want to be naked around the other sex, I sort of get that. But at least for bathrooms where you've got one-holers, who cares? Why? I mean, and people don't listen to that anyway. If I'm at a restaurant and the women's room's busy, I'm going to go use a bathroom, right? And it's not an act of protest, although it could become one if we go to North Carolina. It's just, you know, that's the way it is.
Single stall restrooms should all be gender neutral. There's no reason at all to have gendered labels. As you stated, like, it makes no sense when there's definitely one unit. And with the fear with, you know, multi-stall restrooms, I mean, I think it's complex. And I think it is this fear that's not really based on fact when it comes to like those pieces of fearing violence from the other person, from the other sex. And what we know is that, you know, when somebody is committing, the biggest worry is around like sexual assault and rape. And when we think about people who are committing sexual assault and rape, they are already breaking the law. They're already violating the law. Clearly the law is not what's preventing them. We know that there are so many assaults that happen to women, to men, to any gender identity in our country. And those are happening now with gender segregated spaces. So clearly that piece is not working for the reason, the argument you keep defaulting back to when we say, why can't we have these spaces? Your first argument is this fear of violence that's going to happen against women. And we're like, well, women are already experiencing violence. That is a known fact, in that, you know, our country needs to do much more in that area and arena. And so if that's already happening with these spaces that we create, what would it shift like? Would it potentially, you know, provide a better space? We don't really know what that's going to look like. But we do know that, you know, the biggest fear of the trans piece, like people keep citing, men would, you know, just put on dresses and then go into a women's restroom to assault a woman. And we're like, okay, so again, it's not the trans person who is messing up. You're again saying that men are going to do this and break the law. But we're like, men already do this. We know that sexual assault is rampant. And I don't think that that's the argument to lie on. But I think that, again, when it comes to like our bodies and violence and nudity, there's lots of things about our culture that
make it difficult. You know, maybe if we had sort of co-ed bathrooms everywhere, then, like, you know, if a man did do something mean to a woman, there'd be another man there to go, hey.
Well, and that's kind of does it actually provide a better, safer space by not having these segregated spaces? And it potentially could. And I think the thing is, like, we don't know. But I don't think that that's a proper argument to, like, argue why not to have those spaces. I really don't. I know the different arguments that are out there, but I don't really think that any of them really are based on a lot of fact. I think they're based on these fears and stigmas that really don't play out when we look at what the facts are. One fact that has been highlighted throughout this North Carolina bill process was that when you look at the number of Republicans in Congress who have been convicted of some sort of assault within a public restroom or space, that it outnumbers the number of trans people, because the number of trans people is zero.
That's funny.
So it is pulling out that piece again. It's
so
like, are we looking
at the legislator bathroom and the non-legislator bathroom?
Like, we're looking at the wrong people as the predators, and I think that we need to, like, refocus the conversation for sure.
Well, that's an interesting point. The other thing that occurs to me is this sort of cultural thing, right? You know, you go out to dinner, women and men, and the ladies go off to the women's restroom, and they go in the bathroom, and they talk about the men. They talk about their husbands or their boyfriends or, you know, I don't know, the cute guy at the bar maybe, right? And there's this sort of chick safety thing that happens in the bathroom that, you know, I wonder, you know, if losing that is part of the issue, maybe?
Maybe.
I don't know. I mean, I always felt kind of on the fringe of that, right? Because I'm gay, so and I'm kind of butch. So, you know, I'd go in the bathroom, but I wouldn't really want to talk about makeup. Yeah. And, right. You know, and so, but it was also, you know, it's kind of a feeling of being included.
There are spaces where I think, you know, there is a time and space where having that gender, like, kind of segregated space can be really impactful, just like having different spaces for different identities. And I think the one thing I haven't mentioned that I just want to make sure I do is that at the moment, the other piece of gender identities, because we've been talking a lot in binary language about men and women.
Right.
And the one thing I do want to highlight is that, at the moment, unless they are a single stall restroom that is gender neutral, that, you know, many trans people don't identify as male or female and might identify as gender queer or gender nonconforming. And for those folks at the moment, there's really no
safe space
for them. So, but yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't even thinking about that. There you go. See, I'm a product of the dominant culture. Wow. Okay. Well, I think it's time for us to take a little break here, just momentarily, for me to say the thing that I'm supposed to say every 15 minutes or so, which is that you're listening to Straight Talk on WPVC 94.7 FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. And now that I have duly done my duty, I'm going to come back and I want to ask you guys a little bit more. Is there anything else you want to tell me specifically about what you're doing, or about, you know, about the future of this movement, about the future of trans healthcare, what do you see as the most positive outcome 10, 20 years down the road of the kind of things you're going to do at this symposium? What does utopia look like here, guys? Doc, you tell me.
Okay. I think what I see out of it is that it's not going to be that, hopefully going on, we won't have to have special symposiums like this just to cover this issue, that it'll be considered an integral part of healthcare and mental health care and of life, that we're not, you know, right now I think there's a focus on it because there's such a need. But I think that as time goes on with training and with experience, and as we train younger healthcare providers coming up, and as the culture hopefully continues to change, because I think I've seen a big change in the last 4 years, 5 years, that there'll be much more acceptance and just understanding that, the, you know, this population has certain things that you need to address when you see them, or certain healthcare needs, mental health needs, just as any other population does. The person with diabetes, or the person with mm-hmm. cancer, or the person who's just generally healthy and is coming in for well care. And so that for me, I would see that. And then getting rid of some of these, or not having to have in front of the legislature what bathrooms people can use, that there would be more gender neutral, which would cover everybody.
It's interesting, just sort of, it's interesting to me that in order to access these health services that you need as a trans person, you must, in some systems, have a diagnosis of essentially a mental disorder in order to get the services you need. And I wonder if you know, and so at the moment, there's this focus on getting this diagnosis so you can get the health services. But I wonder if in 20 years, that will cease to be a diagnosis, right? We'll transition to the point where we'll look at that the way we looked at making homosexuality a mental disorder and go, well, it's not really a disorder. It's just, you know, this is how you want it to be. You know, you want your ears pierced. You don't want your ears pierced. You want these hormones, those hormones. I wonder if that will change.
I think I'm hopeful it does. There's been a shift already. The diagnosis previously used to be gender identity disorder. So mm-hmm. it truly was labeled as a disorder. And it has been, at least in the DSM-5, which is the new mental health or classifications mm-hmm. for mental health disorders, it's been shifted to dysphoria, which is progress. And I do think that eventually we will move further away
so
from that.
I'm hopeful. You don't have a disorder, you're just unhappy.
Unhappy,
with.
Right.
I'm unhappy with my gender.
So I'm hopeful that that will change. I also think that even this diagnosis doesn't cover the broad spectrum of what the needs are or what the issues are. And so I do hope that over time that will change.
Tell me what you mean when you say even this diagnosis doesn't cover the broad spectrum of what the needs are. Tell me.
Because
tell me
I'm not sure that everybody is dysphoric about their need. I mean, I think they have needs to come in. When you come in, they may just say, I need this medication to help me feel better about how I feel. But they may not be dysphoric about it. So
right.
you're labeling them as having
mentally ill.
Or that, you know, and they, so I think it, you know, I think that's such a broad spectrum of what people's needs are and what they would like to talk about and what kind of help they need. And, you know, this requirement of having them to see mental health people does, you know, that is a barrier. I think it is useful. And I think for especially younger people as they're trying to sort of sort out what their identity is, it is very helpful, especially if you're going to use medications that are going to have changes that some of which are permanent. But again, I think people can talk about those things and understand them and learn about them. And usually, actually, when my patients come, they know a lot already because they've read a lot and talked to other people. But I think you can deal with that without having to sort of make this diagnosis of dysphoria. And actually, when I tell patients, after I was talking earlier about having to have a code and all for billing purposes with insurance, sometimes I do have to put down gender identity disorder or to get paid for or an endocrine disorder. And I tell my patients, because I know it's going to show up somewhere,
right.
and I let them know I'm not...
This is not,
this
what
not
I personally think about this.
But I'm doing this so that your insurance will pay for this care or these services.
Right.
So,
It's a little bit different than homosexuality in that way, in that it wasn't ever like you had to have a diagnosis of gay in order to get medical
right.
services. So I wonder, you know, how the insurance industry's involvement in this is going to play out long term.
I will tell you, I think that they are getting better with the insurance industry. I think looking even at UVA of how in January they changed what they will cover,
mm-hmm.
Including surgeries and cross-sex hormone care.
What do you mean UVA changed what they will cover? Tell
their,
us about
that. Their health insurance policy.
For who? For UVA employees?
For employees and staff.
Okay.
Now covers transgender services, including surgeries and including cross-sex hormone care. Other universities have and other places have done that in the past, but mm-hmm. I think that's a real big change that's coming up because these things are very expensive. They're expensive health care, but they are needed services that this population needs.
Mm-hmm.
And wants, and I'm really happy to see that shift. And I think other insurances, that's been my impression, are really starting to say, yes, they will cover these services. They will cover this.
What is driving that? I mean, insurance companies, you know, and Darth Vader are similar in
right.
my mind. So I'm trying to picture, like, what, you know, what caused this largesse?
I think advocacy is helping with it. I think seeing that there is this need and people asking for these services.
It's a cultural shift.
I think it's a cultural shift more. I don't know. What would you say you also think is driving? I think the Affordable Care Act has helped some in the sense of broadening services.
You mean the evil Obamacare?
Right. Broadening services for everybody. And so looking and saying, yes, these are needs and services. I mean, 6 years ago, I had health insurances that wouldn't cover birth control for people. So the fact that, you
seriously,
know.
Seriously, 6 years ago, we had health insurance that would not cover your birth control.
Yeah, I had to come up with other reasons why they needed birth control rather than birth control. They'd cover care of the baby, but, you know, not preventing it. But I think, so I think there is just a shift in general of what people need and want and require.
Well, it comes from that sort of Puritan, you know, people don't have sex. We don't want anyone having sex. Therefore, we can't cover anything that might be involved in sex, except the end product of sex is...
Right, we'll cover that.
Because we love babies.
Yeah, right.
Were you going to say something after?
I think, too, like a big piece of, in addition, I definitely agree. I think the cultural shift is huge for insurance. But I think the other piece that's driving it is, as you mentioned, the Affordable Care Act. And I think that as the Affordable Care Act really starts enforcing their non-discrimination clauses, I think that, again, having that authority piece is driving things. We've seen some states, I think it's around 10 or 11 states at this point, who have said all of their options in their health marketplace have to cover certain transition-related care. And so I think as we're seeing more policies and law that are saying, well, with these insurances, you have to cover it. I think one of the biggest recent changes, which has been really tremendous, I think, and we'll have a big shift later on, is Medicare took away and removed their exclusion from transition-related surgeries. Medicare, for a little bit at least, you've been able to get your hormone treatment covered if you did have Medicare, but they did remove that piece. And I think, too, more as we educate, I think people who have the power and corporate and monetary means to start educating. One of the biggest things I like, you know, to pull out when it comes to cost is, I think if insurance companies really sat down, because money is always the big issue. Mm-hmm. Non-trans people sometimes where they're like, well, I don't want to pay, just with any type of healthcare. It's right. Like, I don't want to pay for somebody else getting this thing done, and that's going to make my insurance jack up.
Right.
And I think one of the biggest things is, and research studies that keep showing is, like, if you look at the amount of money that is being spent from insurance on mental health care, hospitalizations, and patient care, all of this mental health care for trans people, just because most of it is around because they can't access the care that they actually need. And so if but when you look at that cost compared to how much it would actually cover, just in terms of how much money you'd be spending to cover surgeries and hormones, it is such a small fraction of that cost. And so it is just, again, trying to show people, it's like your money is actually better spent in providing these services. And as more insurance companies change, you know, some Anthem policies in Virginia, it's just changed in 2016 to say, guess what, we are covering surgery. We'll only cover certain types of surgery. The rest is still seen as cosmetic. So that's a big shift too, is again, right, showing the medical necessity piece. And I think that DSM mental health diagnosis also kind of creates an argument about, well, if we're saying that they have this mental health issue, then how can we assume this is medically necessary? So it is that back and forth and push and pull. And I think that, again, all we see is progress. And I think if people do take a step back and think about where we were at, even I can even just think about, like, you know, when I was 16 and trying to figure out this process, and then thinking about the people that I talked to are in their 50s and 60s and were trying to navigate these things 20 or 30 years ago, to see the progress that's been made even in the last 10 to 15 years is monumental. And that's why I think, like, you know, as you were asking about, like, 10 to 20 years, I think it'll be, you know, we will see a shift in that. I think 20 years from now, a lot of these, you know, conversations and discourse back and forth won't be in existence, because I think we'll have figured out all the kinks, because it's only in the last really 3 to 4 years that this has become like a national attention kind of issue.
Right.
And so and we've seen big changes just within 3 to 4 years. And so I think as we progress, I definitely think, you know, as insurance companies get more on the game of realizing this actually is a beneficial thing for us. Having these policies is good because it means organizations like Capital One, you know, it's a big one in Richmond that's LGBTQ inclusive. So that's why I always have that one in my back pocket. But those big corporations that can shell out a lot of money, right? that can shell out a lot of money are going to look for those policies, right? Because they culturally need to make sure that they are being appropriate, being, you know, the progressive people out on front, or else they're going to lose business. So if you can get those large companies on board.
In terms of,
exactly,
you know, yeah, social like the boycotts in North Carolina, right? Yeah. There's the reverse situation there. Mm-hmm. And then there's just really what you're saying, it sounds like, is that this is like preventive health care, right? If you make people healthier now, you will not have as many costs later. That healthy can also sometimes be happy.
Yeah, exactly. And like the more providers are who are on board, and again, not with just providing trans medicine, with providing preventative care. I mean, there's a wonderful but devastatingly sad documentary produced years ago called Southern Comfort about a trans man who could not find a provider to give him a pap smear. That's all he needed. And he ended up dying as a result of ovarian cancer because no providers would take him because he was trans. And we still unfortunately do see providers who, as soon as somebody says they're trans, they're like, we can't serve you. Not even asking, well, what did you need? Because maybe we could have served
you. Maybe all you need is a flu shot.
Exactly. And so I think, you know, and that's something that I think is the shift that I hope to see in 10 years, is that we don't have to use these stats like that say we know that 20% of trans people have been just straight up denied going to a doctor. I don't want that to have happened. I want to say that anybody who needed to go to a doctor could go to a doctor and not fear either not go to a doctor because they're afraid they're going to be discriminated against, or actually be discriminated against or harassed.
Well, it sounds like the trajectory is good. So I think it's time for us to wrap up. This has been a great show, you guys. Thanks so much for coming. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having
us. Appreciate you being here. This is 94.7 WPVC-FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and you have been listening to Straight Talk. Straight Talk is a local program dealing with law and social justice issues produced right here in Charlottesville by our very own Olivia August. I'm Audrey Hakes, signing off for Straight Talk. Have a great weekend, y'all.
This has been Straight Talk with your host, Audrey Hayes, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Production is from Olivia August. Engineering, Mike Friend. Be sure and listen again next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for Straight Talk on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.